Today we're doing Messianic predictions. We call it the Olivet Discourse. We're going to be looking at Matthew 24, 25, mainly. We will cross over into Mark 13. He has some things to say about this, and we will also look in Luke 21. So if you're using your Bibles, you might want to bookmark all three of those as they're shown on your screen. Now we have 12 disciples. These are apostles. They have two basic questions, and Jesus gives them a very long answer. This is late Tuesday afternoon on our timeline, which is also on your screen. This has been a very long and trying day for Jesus, and he was tried and tested by the opposition. But Jesus has the final word, and it is harsh. And we're going to look at that today before we begin in the predictions on Matthew 24, 25. We're going to look at Matthew because he has this final rebuke to the leaders on late Tuesday afternoon. So if you turn in your Bible to Matthew 23, we will be starting in verse 1. Now, I will be reading this in the ESV, but you can follow along in any translation that you choose. So 23, verse 1 of Matthew. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do. For they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long, and they love the place of honor at feasts and the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. And call no one man your father on earth, for you have one father who is in heaven. Neither be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Christ. The greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the kingdom of God in people's faces, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte, and when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, 'If anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing, but if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath.' You blind fools, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, 'Oh, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, then he is bound by his oath.' You blind men, for which is greater, the gift of the altar or the altar that makes the gift sacred? For whoever swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done, but without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, so that the outside also may be clean. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'Oh, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding of the blood of the prophets.' Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore, I send you the prophets, and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some of whom you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. These are the words of Jesus Christ. As Jesus closes, he is lamenting. He is weeping over his beloved city like a Jeremiah. He thinks back on the vineyard of Isaiah, the vineyard of that's going to be broken down. And he is now spent. He goes and he sits in the corner of the court of women, and he sees a widow, as we saw last week, put all she has left into the treasury. This is a perfect close to what he has said about the lack of mercy and the absence of justice in the nation and in its leaders. So now let's go to our text and listen in on the conversation that takes place after Jesus and the 12 leave the temple. And now I like Mark because his language is most colorful. And as I've mentioned before, Mark is the most chronological in his account. So let's go to Mark 13. Let's start there. As we look at this, as they leave this Tuesday afternoon, leaving the temple. Now, on your screen is a slide of the temple, and I have the arrow pointing out. This is the path they will take. They will go out of that gate and across this little Kidron Valley and climb up the hill to the Mount of Olives. Now, it says in 13:1, as he came out of the temple, one of the disciples said to him, look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. And as they cross the Kidron Valley and begin to climb up toward the Mount of Olives, the disciples can look back and they can see the buildings and they can see the expanse of the temple. And Jesus gives them an answer that is basically the same in all three Gospels. We're going to look in Mark chapter 13, verse 2. Jesus said to him, do you see these great buildings? These buildings you call wonderful is what he's pointing at. There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. Whereas Matthew says there will not be one stone that is left sitting upon another. Now they are in awe of the greatness of the temple. We can't overstate the magnificence of the temple. But as they get up to the Mount of Olives, and I have a picture here of Jesus sitting overlooking this temple from the Mount of Olives, we can't overstate what they see, the gold and the ivory. When I go to D.C. and I look at the great monuments there, I simply look at them and I have no doubt they will endure. They seem to be indestructible, as we sometimes often think that our country is going to last forever. I assume that it's at least going to last as long as I'm alive, which, considered my age, not that much longer. Moving on from that, when they hear this answer that Jesus gives, this little inner group comes up to him with a couple questions. And they're, I think, disturbed by what he's told them. And he says in verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately. Now, I want you to notice something here, that this little inner group, Peter, James, and John, these three were with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. These are kind of the inner core of the apostles, of the 12. Now, notice as Andrew comes with them. Andrew is Peter's brother, and it is Andrew who actually followed Jesus very early, right after his ministry with John the Baptist. And Andrew's the one who went to Peter and said, hey, come and see, I think I found the Messiah. So these four men are close. Peter, James, and John, they're all fishermen. And of course, Andrew is in that same family with Peter. So they go to him in verse 4 and they say, tell us, when will these things be? What they're asking in that first question is, when will the temple be destroyed, as you've just said? When will it be that not one stone will be left upon another? And the second question is, what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Now, Matthew, and we're going to look at this in a minute, Matthew actually gives a two-part question here. And the two-part question in the second question, what will be the sign, is what will be the sign of your coming and what is the sign of the end of the age? But all three Gospels have the same basic questions here, and it is only Mark who says it is a private question from these four disciples, and of course Jesus goes on to speak to all 12 of them. But all three Gospels give exactly the same answer, nearly word for word. In verse 5, Jesus answered them and says, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name," and Matthew adds here, "saying that I am the Christ," or "I am the Messiah," "and they will lead many astray." Now, did you notice this? He does not answer their two basic questions. He doesn't answer either one. And what I find most amazing is that in saying what Jesus says, Jesus came and clearly said and showed that "I am the Messiah," and the leadership didn't believe him. Verse 5 really is saying, you better be careful, you better beware. You guys, I'm telling you, see that no one leads you astray. Verse 6, he goes on to say, because many are going to be led astray by many messiahs. Now, we know now, because of the revelation that will come later through John, that this will culminate, these many, many messiahs will culminate in one false messiah, and that the modern Israel that exists now and has existed since 1948 will receive this false messiah with open arms. And what Israel is going to do as a nation through its leaders is Israel is going to complete the total apostasy that began when the nation rejected Jesus, the true Christ, and then moving forward into the future, the nation will accept the false Christ. And this is the apostasy that Paul outlines in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I have that on the screen, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. Paul is giving the Thessalonians a warning here, that saying, you're not in the day of the Lord. Don't let anybody deceive you in any way as if you were in the day of the Lord. He says, for that day of the Lord, will not come unless the rebellion. Now, Paul uses this as a technical term here. This is not just apostasy or falling away from the faith in general. This is specific. This is the apostasy. Hey, apostasia. This is what he says comes first. What he's saying here is that there's a man of sin coming. At first, he's going to fool them. And the man of lawlessness is then going to be revealed, he says. That's his mask is going to be removed. And who he is, he's the son of destruction. He's not the prince of peace they have so long desired. It says in verse 4 that he opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God, thus defiling the very temple that he allowed them to build a few years earlier. Now, understand, the nation of Israel, as it exists today, is just as wicked and just as godless as the nation of Israel was in 33 AD. And when this new false Messiah, Christ, arises and proclaims himself to be their Messiah, promising peace and a new temple, they will gladly receive him, as will all the Gentile nations of the world. Because you know what he's going to do? He's going to bring the impossible. He's going to bring peace to Jerusalem. He's going to allow the people of Israel to build a new temple in Jerusalem, while at the same time, he's going to maintain control of Jerusalem. See, before this one man comes, Jesus wants to warn his disciples. And notice, look at verse 6 again. For many will come in my name, and they will lead many astray. So what is important for us today? It's the same thing that Jesus told the disciples. And one of those disciples that's sitting there listening is John. And later, he's going to tell the church. In about 90 AD, he's going to say in 1 John 2:18, and that's also on your screen, children, it is the last hour. As you have heard that Antichrist is coming, and he's talking about a specific person when he says that Antichrist. So he goes on to say, so now many antichrists have come. There are many, many people who are false teachers and false prophets will come. And therefore we know that it is the last hour. We are in this time that Jesus warned us about. And when he says it's the last hour, well, that last hour has been going on since at least the time John wrote this in 90 AD. And we are in the last days. When did the last days begin? The last days began when Jesus ascended into glory. And he left his apostles behind. And notice what he says in 1 John 1:7, for many deceivers from that point on, and Paul warned about this Even in the book of Acts, many deceivers have gone out into the world. He told the Ephesian elders that false teachers will arise from among your own selves. In your church, false teachers are going to arise. These are deceivers. These who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. And that's a basic principle of Gnosticism, which John was battling, the claim that Jesus really was not a man, he was simply a spirit being. John says, such a one is the deceiver and the Antichrist. John also tells us that the many will be a long succession that ends in one. So let's go back to our question. When will these things happen? When will not one stone be left on another? Well, Matthew and Mark do not answer this one question in this context, but Luke does. Luke does answer the question. So now we're going to go to Luke 21:20. He says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and these are the armies of the ruler Vespasian and Titus, who's the general, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter it, for these days are days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. Now notice he says, when you see the siege begin to take place, when you see that Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, then don't go back in there. Stay away, because at the end of that siege will be total destruction. So don't go back in there. Luke is saying is it will fulfill what Jesus had just said in Matthew 23:38. Jesus, in his lament, had told them, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, see, your house is left to you desolate. I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And he had told the Pharisees and the scribes, after calling them hypocrites, he told them, these things will come upon this generation. So what Luke is answering is what is going to happen to the generation of Jews that are living right then? Well, they're going to see the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So when Jesus says, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, he's talking about his coming in the future. This is Psalm 118, and they had said this as they sang at the triumphal entry the Sunday before. Then that same crowd, however, that sang out, oh, blessed is the one coming, that same crowd will cry out for his crucifixion on the coming Friday. But see, in the future, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord will be sung when he comes in his glory. Well, he goes on and he continues his warning in verse 23. Alas, for women who are pregnant and those who are nursing infants in those days, for there will be great distress upon the earth and wrath against this people. Now, this is really the temple destruction. I have a picture of that on the screen showing the temple destruction. And verse 24 closes by saying, they will fall by the edge of the sword. Those who are trapped in the city, the women who are pregnant, the women who are nursing, the men who didn't get out, they will be caught by the edge of the sword. Many will be killed. Josephus claims that 1 million people were killed because this is during Passover time. Some scholars think his number was exaggerated, but thousands upon thousands of people were killed. Because remember, at Passover, 100,000 to 150,000 people would come in from surrounding nations. It says they would fall by the edge of the sword. And notice what it says. They will be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, that has to be explained, because Luke is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem that leads to a worldwide scattering, a continued Gentile domination of Jerusalem, the Gentile domination that began under the Babylonians, then went to the Medo-Persians, then went to the Greeks, is now under Rome. He's saying that Gentile domination will continue, and it does continue to this day. Even though Israel is a nation, it does not control the city of Jerusalem. But the domination, notice in the language, the domination has a future end point until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There will become an end of Gentile domination of Jerusalem. This complete destruction of Jerusalem is not the end of the Jews. It is the beginning of their worldwide dispersion. They will be regathered, however, by their Messiah, Jesus Christ. So what Luke is doing here, he's mixing in far aspects of the return of Jesus with the near predictions of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And it's very common in the Bible to see near and far predictions of prophecies mingled together. Moses did it. The prophets did it. In fact, Moses talked about, in Deuteronomy 26 through 30, a worldwide scattering of the Jewish people, but then a promise of the Jewish people that they would be, in fact, returned to their land. Moses is talking to a group of people that will never see worldwide scattering. In fact, they're on their way into the land. But he talks far off into the future, as if he's talking to them about, you will be scattered. This is the same thing that's being mingled together here. But let's go now to the next question, directly addressed by both Matthew and Mark. And we're going to take our question from Matthew because it's, again, it's really a two-part question. So we're going to look at Matthew 24:3. I have that on your screen for you. But Matthew 24:3, he says, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, as we saw in Mark, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? That is the destruction of the temple. And what will be the sign of your coming? That's part number one of the second question. And what will be the sign of the end of the age? That is part number two of the second question. I'm not going to address or cover all of the events that Matthew describes next, all of the signs that he describes there. There are dozens of commentaries that cover these, and most of them, I'm sorry to say, are searching for some clue as to which sign will tell us when Jesus is coming. And those that claim to know the answer are always 100% historically wrong, and they will continue to be wrong. And I myself fell victim to this in my early Christian life, as have some of you. Lately, there's been the talk about the red moon twice in a month. That's certainly, those are a sign that Jesus is coming. No, it's not. When you hear those kinds of things, just put your hand over your ears and stop listening, because there are no signs to tell us when Jesus is coming. Having said that, I'm going to just go back and I'm going to focus on two basic points in this passage. First, I'm going to talk about the revelation of the Antichrist, the first thing Jesus talks about. Then I'm going to talk about the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, that's not the order that the disciples asked the question, but it's the order in which Jesus gives the answers. The second part of the second question, if you look at your screen, Matthew 24:3, what will be the sign of the end of the age? Well, Jesus says there's going to be a rebel, the rebel, is going to be revealed. So he says in verse 15, when you see, and that's a seeing something is a sign, like a stop sign, or a sign is what you can clearly see. Your actions will be determined by what that sign says. If a sign says stop, you stop. Well, he says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, notice Jesus is going to refer to Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. Let the reader understand what Jesus means here is let the reader know and understand what Daniel was talking about. And he says, when you see the abomination of desolation, you got very little time left, then you better flee to the mountains. And he goes on to say, woe to those who are pregnant in those days, and I hope it's not winter. Because you won't be able to run fast enough, because things are going to unfold very, very quickly. Now, Matthew and Mark do not address the destruction of Jerusalem. They address the defilement of Jerusalem, the defilement of a temple that exists in the future, a temple that Israel is able to build because of their agreement with a false Messiah who promises to protect them and bring them peace. Now, notice Matthew references Daniel. But so does Luke. Luke references Daniel. He just does it a little more indirectly. If we go to Daniel 9, we can see the events outlined in Luke and Matthew are predicted by Daniel the prophet. So back in Daniel 9, and I want you to see this in your own Bibles, just simply going to read. Again, I'm using the ESV. Daniel 9:25 is where we're going to start, but I will point out that Daniel 9:24 says, 70 weeks have been determined for your people and for your holy city. Now, when he says 70 weeks, that's 490 years. And he says that these years have been decreed for your people, that's the Jewish people, because those are Daniel's people, and for your holy city, that would be Jerusalem, because that's the city Daniel is concerned about. You, Daniel, are to know, that's know, and discern, that's understanding. Notice what Matthew said, let the reader understand. I want the reader to understand this, that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, that's Jesus Christ, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now that's a total of 69 weeks. He goes on to say, in the first 7 weeks, that's 49 years, it, the city of Jerusalem, will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. So notice, this first 69 weeks has been broken into two parts, a 7 week period, 49 years, and a 62-week period, which is 434 years. So he goes on in 9:26 to say, then after 62 weeks, that's 7 plus 62 is 69, would be the total, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. So this happens 483 years after the decree is given, Messiah is cut off. Now Messiah is Jesus Christ. And what's it mean to be cut off? He's going to die. How's he going to die? He's going to die on a cross. He's going to die on a cross and have nothing. He has nothing to his name when he dies. So this is after the 69th week is ended. It is in this time period, in this gap, the Passion Week passes and the coming and destruction of Jerusalem and the Romans takes place. All of these events fall in between the 69th and 70 weeks of Daniel. The church is also born in this gap and lives in this gap of time, and we are still in this gap of time. The 70th week has not yet begun. No person has stepped forward to offer the nation of Israel peace and the promise to rebuild the temple and the promise to stand, in fact, as their Messiah. No one has done that yet. So after Jesus dies, there is the destruction of Jerusalem. That is what Luke writes about. Continuing in verse 26, it says, and the people of the prince who is to come. Who are the people of the prince who is to come? Well, the people of the prince who is to come are the Romans. They will destroy the city and the sanctuary. They, in fact, destroyed the city and the sanctuary in 70 AD. And its end, that's the city's end, and the temple's end, will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. Another way to say that Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot, completely destroyed until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. This is what Luke describes, destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, the next verse describes the defilement of Jerusalem. This is the defilement of a future Jerusalem, the beginning of the 70th week. Notice how this starts, 9:27, and he, who's the he? The he is the prince above. Person who comes from the Western Roman Empire will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. What's 1 week? The apostasy that begins the 70th week, the seven-year period, the final seven-year period that is yet to come. But he says, but in the middle of the week, that would be at the 3.5-year point, dividing that 7.5, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. Now, you can only have sacrifice and grain offering in Jerusalem if there's a temple. And he is the one who's allowed them to build a temple. And then it says, on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. Now, I have said for years that to understand prophecy, one must understand Daniel. And of course, I think Matthew agrees with that because he says, let the reader understand. Now, this is not just for the timelines that Daniel gives in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 8. What nations follow other nations that are going to be in control of Jerusalem and maintain control of Jerusalem until Messiah comes? And so it's not just for the timeline, but it's for us to see clearly that all these prophecies are for the Jews. That's not for the church. We want to understand this so we're not fooled by latter-day prophets and date setters who tell us that Jesus is coming right around the corner because I know I saw this sign. This sign is in Daniel. This sign is in Matthew. That's not there. Paul teaches the same thing Jesus teaches. He is assuming a knowledge of Daniel. He's assuming that we understand Daniel. 2 Thessalonians 2:3, I put it on your screen here. Paul says that this prince of 9:26-27, he says he's the lawless man. He is the one revealed. Notice 2:3, and the man of lawlessness is revealed. Now that word is apokalypsis, and we get our word apocalypse from that. This is the revelation of the man of lawlessness at the 3.5-year point. And he says, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Notice that. This is the same thing that Daniel references when he says this abomination of desolation takes place through this one who makes a covenant with the many for 1 week and in the middle of the week breaks that covenant. So the sign which Daniel predicted, it is exactly in the middle of the seven-year tribulation, and it's a sign clearly seen. It's a sign that will tell all who understand that they are clearly in the midst of the 70th week of Daniel and that the coming of the Son of Man is just 3.5 years away. And this will tell the Jewish people where they are in the midst of this apostasy. This is an apocalypse. This is a revealing that precedes the apocalypse or the revelation or the revealing of Jesus. It also begins the time that Jesus calls the greatest tribulation that Israel or the world will ever see. He says in verse 21, if you look down there, "For then there will be a great tribulation such as not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. Because once the Antichrist defiles the temple and breaks his covenant with the Jews, he will proceed and try to wipe them all out. He will try to wipe out all of the Jewish people as well as anyone who stands with them for Jesus Christ. It is also the time of the greatest deception the world will ever see." Notice verse 23. "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'Here is the Messiah,' there he is, don't believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible," which it's not possible, "but if possible, even the elect of Jesus Christ." Now, Paul says the Antichrist will be surrounded by many false signs and wonders. This is as demonic forces are unleashed around the world. And we see this in the book of Revelation. But I want you to look at this slide where Paul does talk about this. And he says, 2 Thessalonians 2:9-11, he says, "The coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan with all power and false signs and wonders and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing, because they refuse to love the truth so as to be saved. Therefore, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what is false." What is a strong delusion? When this Antichrist takes power, he's going to proclaim himself as God, as Paul has said. He's going to say, "Follow me. I am the true Messiah of Israel. All others before me are false, including that one you people call Jesus of Nazareth. He's, of course, a false Messiah. I am here to protect you. I am here to bring you peace." At this point, he's going to lash out against the people of Israel. The strong delusion, he's going to say, "In order to show that you serve me, you're going to take a mark I'm going to put on your forehead or on your right hand." If you want to study that, see the book of Revelation. But people who believe him, who refuse to believe the truth and follow him, will take his mark. Now, the first part of the question that was asked in the book of Matthew, which is, what will be the sign of your coming? On the next slide, I outline it here. Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming? So we're focusing on what will be the sign of your coming. This is Matthew 24:27-30. This is the Son revealed. So Jesus actually answers the first part of the question second as we move later into the chapter. So Matthew 24:27, "For as lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather." This means there will be death, there will be war involved in his coming, and we know that from the book of Revelation as well. Verse 29, "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken." These are obvious, visible signs that something dramatic is happening. And he says in verse 30, "Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." Now, who's going to mourn when they see the Son of Man? I think it's the nation of Israel, first and foremost, is going to mourn because they're going to see that this, in fact, was our Messiah and we crucified him. And they will mourn over that fact as he's coming down to regather them and to actually save them as a people. So a sign clearly seen, obvious, visible, like lightning, the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and glory, great glory. And a sign clearly predicted, again by Daniel, a sign for Jews to see, yet also to be seen by the whole world. I'm going to want you to look at Daniel 7:13 because this is clearly in there. Daniel 7:13 and 14, it says there, "With the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man." Notice where this language comes from that Matthew used. And Jesus calls himself Son of Man, came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And in 14 it says, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. This is the final apocalypse, the final revealing, not of a false Christ, but of the true Christ, and a coming that brings an end to the deceiver, to the rebel. That's 2 Thessalonians 2:8, whom the Lord will kill with the breath of his mouth and bring him to nothing by the appearance of his coming. He's talking about the end of this man of lawlessness spoken of in 2 Thessalonians 2:3. And when Jesus does return, he returns to his people and to his nation to establish the kingdom promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And his coming is marked by a great gathering. Not a scattering, as described in Luke, but a gathering of Jewish people, 24:31. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and he will gather his elect. And in Greek, that word elect is chosen. He will gather his chosen. Who are his chosen people? His chosen people have always been the nation of Israel. This is going to be a glorious day because he's going to gather his elect from the four winds from one end of heaven to the other. And once he has gathered his people, the Jewish people, then he will gather all the nations, all of the Gentile nations of the world who have survived the tribulation, and they will all stand before him, and he will have his people with him that he's just gathered, and then they, these Gentile nations, they will be separated, some for the kingdom and some for the destruction in the future lake of fire. 25:31. We're going to jump from 24:31 over to 25:31, because this really picks up the narrative, which is interrupted by several parables that really describe what's it like when the master leaves or the king leaves. What's it like for people he's left behind? He's clearly indicating he's going away, but that he is going to come back. But notice when he does come back, 25:31, when the Son of Man comes, but when he comes, he's not going to stay in the clouds. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. And you know, when he comes with all of his angels with him, that's not all that come with him. You know who else comes with him? His church comes with him. The bride of Christ comes with him. The bride that he has snatched out of the world and separated from the wrath of God that's going to be poured out on the world. He separated his bride from the world, and they've been with him for this past 7 years. In verse 32, before him will be gathered all the nations. These are the Gentiles. And he will separate people. That's Gentiles. One from another. Like, this is a simile here. Like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. It says in verse 33, he will place the sheep, now he's talking about people, don't lose sight of that, on his right, and the goats, people, on the left. Then the king will say to those people on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. 41, jump down to verse 41. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And these, verse 46, the goats, the people on the left, will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous, the sheep, the people on the right, into eternal life, into the eternal kingdom. Now again, these are Gentiles. What's the distinction? The distinction is between the two groups, he's told both groups, one group, for whatever you did for the least of these, and he points to his people that he's just gathered, the Jewish people, whatever you did for these, the least of my brethren in this time of terrible tribulation they've just gone through, if you have stood up for them, you are did that because you, in fact, are righteous. These sheep are all of those who were not deceived by the Antichrist, who did not take the mark of the beast, and they've survived this tribulation. They're going to go on into the kingdom. Who are the goats? Those that have the mark of the beast on their forehead. That's how they can be separated out. They claim they helped, but they didn't. They didn't stand for the Jewish people. They did not provide for them. Claim, well, didn't we do things in your name? No, I never knew you, he says to them. Go back to Matthew 24:32. Let's go back to that. We skip from 24:31 to 25:31, but we're going to go back to 24:32 because we're going to talk about the fig tree. Jesus is going to say, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, how many of these things? All of them. You know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly I say to you that this generation, now when he says this generation here, he's talking about the generation that sees all these things take place. It's not like the language in Matthew 23 where he's looking directly at the scribes and the Pharisees and saying, this generation, upon you will all these things take place, the destruction of Jerusalem, they will see that. But here he's talking about something different. The generation that sees all these things, all these signs, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Jesus said this same thing in all three Gospels referring to this fig tree. When all these things, not some of them, we in the church, we don't look for these signs. All of the signs here are for the nation Israel in the future. They are going to help them as they're going through this tribulation. When they see the sign of the tribulation, which is the man of lawlessness proclaiming himself to be God in the temple, they will know that they have only 3.5 years of this to wait out. They will be able to look for the coming of their Messiah. They won't be able to know the day exactly, but they'll know that they've only got 3.5 years left. But we don't look for that. In the church age, we look for the coming of Jesus for his church. There is no sign preceding that. Then we will be with Jesus when he returns with his church. When he comes to actually gather the nation of Israel, we will be with him after he has accomplished all these things. And when will this happen? You can't even try to guess. Don't even venture a guess. In verse 36, he says, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son. That's the Son, Jesus, having laid aside his deity. He is now functioning as a human with all the limitations of humanity. He says, I don't know the day or the hour, but only the Father knows the day or the hour, he says in verse 36. We in the church are given no clue as to when that will be. Jesus left this earth. He left his apostles behind to build his church. And Jesus, through them and through church age saints now, building his church. And when he is done building his church, he will then come and return for these apostles that he left behind. He will not only return for those apostles, he will return for all church age saints, whether dead or alive. We don't know when that's going to be. Now, until he does come, we are to remain awake and faithful. Look how emphatic Mark is about this as he writes to his mainly Gentile readers in the church age. People just like us. Go to Mark 13. I want to go there, leave Matthew. Mark 13, 32. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard. Keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey, and when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, notice his work is continuing to serve the master, going on to say, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come. In the evening or at midnight, when the rooster crows, or in the morning, you have no idea. But you stay awake, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you all, stay awake. That's what I have up on the screen. Jesus is emphatic about this, as he clearly says over and over in the Gospels. Stay awake. No one knows. Stay awake. You do not know when he's going to come. And just as Paul tells us in the church now, keep awake and be sober. 1 Thessalonians 5:6. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let's keep awake and be sober, clear-headed, clear-thinking, with a clear purpose. We are to serve the Almighty God as we wait for him to send his Son from heaven. And if we want to really understand the calling and the focus of the church for us, what is our calling? Then I would urge you, read all of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Read it over every day for a week and meditate on it. We can learn a great deal about the will of God from that passage. Because, see, the Father is concerned with our character. He's not concerned about our predictions of when his Son will come. He's not revealed that to us. But he has revealed that we should exhibit the character of the one who is coming. To be compassionate, to be merciful, to be forgiving, and to be loving and tolerant toward others. We are calling people to join and be part of the bride of Jesus Christ. Not only to follow him on this earth, but to follow him into glory with a great destiny. So next week, we're going to look at how the Messiah is betrayed. Betrayed by the apostle named Judas. Judas can be explained, his actions can be explained in some fashion, and I will attempt to do that. But you know, there's a great mystery about Judas. Judas's story is a frightening story. So we're going to cover that in Matthew 26, 1 through 16, Mark 14, Luke 22. Those are the parallels. We're also going to be looking at John 12, which really gives us the background to the betrayal in Matthew 26, 1 through 16. So with that, ask the Lord for his blessing on this word. Jesus, we thank you that you are coming for us. That is your promise. You promised the apostles. He says that when you said, I am going away, but I am coming back to receive you, and I will take you to my Father's house. We don't know when that's going to be, but we look forward to that day. But as we're waiting, we pray that we accomplish your purpose. Reach people with the gospel message of grace, of mercy, and forgiveness. So we turn this all over into your hands. This is the will of God. Amen.